Support for this public radio podcast comes from the Society for Human Resource Management, HR, leading people, leading organizations, online at shrm.org.
His days are numbered.
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From American Public Media in Los Angeles, I'm Scott Jagow. It seems just a matter of time before World Bank President Paul Wolfowitz isn't the World Bank president anymore. Today, the bank's board meets again to decide his fate. Wolfowitz is accused of getting his girlfriend a fat pay package at the bank. He'd like to resign without too much embarrassment, and he has at least one friend in Japan. The Japanese finance minister today said he has high regard for Wolfowitz and the job he's done. Last week, Republicans and Democrats had a major breakthrough on free trade. Republicans agreed to labor and environmental protections in international deals. Democrats said they would support lowering barriers to foreign imports. But both sides seem to be having second thoughts about their breakthrough. John Dimsdale reports from Washington.
Rank-and-file Democrats have been backing away from the deal ever since it was announced. The director of Public Citizens Global Trade Watch, Lori Wallach, says she knows why.
Most of the members of the House Democratic Caucus are asking why it's in the interest of a Democratic majority to facilitate the passage of more Bush-NAFTA-style agreements.
Businesses, too, are not happy now that they've seen the details, according to Claude Barfield of the American Enterprise Institute.
One calls it a compromise, but the compromise was almost entirely on the Republican side.
Gary Huffbauer at the Peterson Institute for International Economics says the leaders on both sides got ahead of their troops.
So now the troops are trying to catch up or trying to figure out what happened.
Supporters hope the deal sticks long enough to pass two relatively easy trade agreements with Peru and Panama. Whether the bipartisanship lasts longer than that depends on just how easy those turn out to be. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
The bulls are still charging on Wall Street. Yesterday, the Dow gained 103 points to 13,487. The NASDAQ added 22 to 2547. And the S&P 500 climbed a healthy 13 points to 1514. Japan's Nikkei lost a fraction today, but other Asian markets had gains. European shares are a little bit higher in early trading. Chicago and Detroit play each other in the NBA playoffs tonight. Some of the other cities left, San Antonio, Phoenix, Cleveland. But the NBA is also thinking about London. The league is opening a new branch office over there. Pat Loeb tells us why.
A London office puts the NBA in the paint for developing new business opportunities in Europe. The continent has been exporting more and more players to the U.S. This season, 52 NBA players are from Europe, and that has more Europeans getting interested in the game. London has just built an NBA-style arena called the O2. A preseason game there between the Boston Celtics and the Minnesota Timberwolves, scheduled for next October, is already nearly sold out. The NBA would like to do more of those kinds of events, according to Mike Bass. He's the NBA's vice president for marketing.
As the opportunity continues to grow the sport and the NBA brand and have people have access not just to our game but to our players, I would say the international appeal is rivaled only by soccer right now.
Bass points out that a British player, Luol Deng, is in the playoffs right now for the Chicago Bulls. Generating more fans with a physical presence in London should be, yes, a slam dunk. I'm Pat Loeb for Marketplace.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans. Introducing ThriveQ, an online tool that helps you know where you stand on your path to retirement. More at ThriveQ.com. By the Duke Executive MBA, developing leaders and accelerating careers around the world with four top-ranked executive MBA programs for working professionals. More at DukeExecutiveMBA.com. And by Mellon Financial Corporation, helping financially successful individuals and families protect and maximize their assets through the practice of wealth management. Mellon.com.
This week, Ohio's attorney general said he might file racketeering charges against Wall Street investment banks. He's investigating their role in the subprime mortgage meltdown. The banks poured tons of money into risky mortgages. Then when things started going bad, the banks pulled out and a lot of subprime lenders were left high and dry. Our economics correspondent Chris Farrell believes the lending culture in this country has changed dramatically.
You know what we've seen? It used to be redlining, was very common in low-income neighborhoods, African-American neighborhoods, Latino neighborhoods, couldn't get loans. And imagine if you go back four decades ago, and by the way, I have no nostalgia about several decades ago when a wife could not take out a loan unless her husband co-signed it. Okay, there's nothing to like about that world.
Right.
But the problem is the level of abuse and how the democratization of credit in low-income neighborhoods is turning into something that makes poverty worse should give us all pause.
So the pendulum has swung too far the other way.
That's right.
Right. But why?
Well, what has happened is this is the great frontier. If you think about the credit industry, the lending industry, you used to always want to lend to the elite. Then we lend to the middle class. Where's your next frontier? The poor. And the technology of credit scoring and the massive databases of our credit reports allowed for lenders to move into low-income neighborhoods and be more sophisticated, more targeted with their lending. Well, can I just give you one example of what I'm talking about?
Sure.
Business Week cover story, The Business of Poverty. So what they note is you have a $30,000 income household, $90,000 income household, auto loan. 1989, the low-income household paid about 17% more than the upper-income household. By 2004, that gap had widened to 56%.
So who is going to stop this cycle from happening?
Well, this is where I think the regulators have been asleep, especially the federal regulators. I have to applaud a lot of state regulators who have been much more aware of the problem. They've been on the ground. But the federal regulators, you know, they seem to be much more concerned about, you know, the credit card industry. Oh, we don't want to interfere. We don't want to interfere with the free market. And they didn't actually look close enough. And they didn't listen to those activists, you know, those pesky activists. They didn't listen to them that, hey, these contracts are really bad. There's a lot of abuse going on here. So I think we need to have on the federal level far more aggressive action.
All right, Chris Farrell, our economics correspondent. Thanks.
Thanks a lot.
In Los Angeles, I'm Scott Jagow. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.